This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at WILL.UIUC.edu. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in today. The Catholic Monastic Order of the Carthusians is the Western world's most austere monastic order. For hundreds of years, the monks have lived in solitude, far from the secular world, in a quest to find God. On the program today, we'll get a glimpse of the Carthusian life. Our guest is Nancy Klein McGuire. She is the author of An Infinity of Little Hours. Nancy Klein McGuire set out to learn about the monks as a result of marrying a former Carthusian. The order, it was founded in the 11th century and survived several upheavals in the church without change. McGuire says, today the elderly members of the order, those who entered before 1965, provide the last opportunity to revisit the life of the 11th century Carthusians. Imagine stepping back to that time. You shut yourself away from the world for a life of prayer and contemplation, deprived of physical comforts and subject to the discomfort of a hair shirt and cold living quarters, taking almost all your daily meals alone and in silence. An Infinity of Little Hours is a history of the Carthusians. It also tells the stories of five young men who entered the monastery at Parkminster in West Sussex, England, in 1960 and 1961. They entered prior to the opening of Vatican II in 1962. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments for our guest, Nancy Klein McGuire. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. An Infinity of Little Hours is published by Public Affairs Books. Again, the phone number is 333-9455 and 800-222-9455. Nancy Klein McGuire, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
I'm delighted to be talking to you, and let me say that was a great summary of the book, a terrific introduction.
Oh, well, thank you. Well, tell us when and how you decided you'd write this book.
Well, as you know from the dust jacket, I'm a cultural historian at the Folger Shakespeare Library in Washington, D.C., and normally I write about 17th century theater and politics. And this was sort of a sheer accident that I found out that, as you just told us, that the Carthusians had not, that they were started in 1094, and they had not changed even the design of their underwear from 1084 until 1965. So what I had locked into was nearly 1,000 years of frozen history, which is not written down anyplace. So it was locked up in the heads of men who were 60, 70, and 80 years old. And after doing research at the Folger for 25 years, the research instinct just took over, and I decided that whatever it cost, I was going to find out about the secret life of these monks, because the secret life of the monks took me right back into the 11th century, with not only the hair shirts, but no electricity, no central heating. The clothes the monks wore were exactly the same as worn by their French century counterparts in the French peasants in the 11th century, except, of course, for the hair shirt, which the peasants did not wear.
Mm-hmm.
So I was hooked, and I thought this was going to be a little article that I would do while I was taking vacation. I was really deep in the mistress of Charles II, and I thought I needed a break because it was really hard work. And so I thought, well, I'll just write this little article about these monks. And I became totally hooked, and I spent 7 years finding out about the monks. The difficulty was, actually, the first draft got written very quickly. About 4 years after I started, I had an 80,000-word typescript, and I coerced my friends at the Folger to read it. And the difficulty was that they either wanted to get out of the monastery immediately or they wanted to become monks. Either one was what I wanted, you know. So I realized that even though I was telling them all about the architecture, the rituals, the statutes, the clothing, the rules, the penances, they really weren't understanding what it was like to live inside this place. So I had to find a way to get inside the monks' heads. So I asked one of my colleagues at the Folger, I was saying, you know, I don't know how to do this. He said, you simply have to track down the monks, mostly ex-monks. I had visited the apartments to monastery several times. So I had a collection of 30 monks about this time. And so I wrote to them and asked them how far they would be willing to divulge their private thoughts, emotions, fears, hesitations. And based on fairly intimate questions, some of them definitely did not want to go any farther. You know, that was their private life, and they could give me all the details about hair shirts I wanted, but they didn't want to talk about what they were afraid of. But some of them were very interested in pursuing this type of history. So on the basis of that, I chose the five young men that you mentioned before who entered between June 1960 and March 1961. And what strikes me so much is that if you look at the insert in the book, they look like such normal young men. The photo insert shows one of them rowing a boat looking like Charles Atlas, another one having dinner with a girlfriend, another one surf casting. So these weren't people who couldn't make it in the outside world. I mean, they were doing very well. So with their help and with tremendous cooperation and transparency, I followed them from their homes in East Berlin, Dublin, Chicago, Brooklyn, New York, and Pennsylvania to the monastery, which the monks, to the English monastery, which the monks call Parkminster.
Yeah. What do they remember about pulling the bell rope on the gate of the charter house?
Well, pulling the bell rope was a pretty dramatic step, because when you pull the bell rope, there are double doors with about a 15-inch grill in the door. And when you pull the doors, a wooden partition slides back, and the brother looks at them and asks them what they want, and if they're expected, they're let inside. But the shocking thing for all of them, what made many of them simply leave, was when the door was shut on what they call their cell, which is where they spend all their time except for going to church three times a day. And when the cell door slammed, some of them actually left, you know, just let me out of here and got the next train to London. It was a very traumatic event for all of them, because even though these cells are 1,500 square feet, which, frankly, I would be very comfortable living in a 1,500 square foot cell, and think about what that would sell on the lakefront in Chicago.
Right.
They're alone. No radio, no television, no clocks, no wristwatches, no correspondence, and they know that no one will ever knock on their door, and they can't leave except to go to church. So they really are face-to-face with themselves in total solitude. One of the young monks, Dom Leo, he recollects this later, about a couple of years ago when he was telling me about this. He said, and he thought hopefully God would be there too, but at this stage of their career as monks, God was not terribly visible. So the first three or four months were extremely difficult as they adjusted to an 11th century regime in a very harsh and austere monastery. So those, if they lasted the first 3 months, they probably made it to the novitiate when they received the clothes of a monk.
Oh. Let's go back and talk a little bit about the hair shirt. It's something today we think of only metaphorically.
I know, it's quite amazing. I actually have a hair shirt, which took me 7 years to get. I tried eBay and every place, and I could not find a hair shirt. The hair shirt is like a sandwich board that people protest in front of the White House with straps over the shoulder. And then at the bottom, like a vest, there's a rope. And if they pull it really tight, it is more irritating. The fabric of the hair shirt is burlap. And the brothers, who are the people who do all the manual labor for the monks, literally sew horse hair between the fibers of the burlap. And the side that has horse hair on it, is put next to the chest, so it provides a constant irritant. I thought I would try it out, so the one that was lent to me, I put on, and after about 5 minutes, I was really irritated.
I imagine it like wearing a rag wool sweater without anything underneath.
Yeah, I think so. I think that would be similar, especially if you're allergic to wool, and you would have that next to your bare skin.
Yeah.
But frankly, most of them got used to that quite readily. That was not the major. That was not the really difficult part about the order.
Yeah, yeah. What is the daily routine like for a novice?
A novice goes to bed. We start at the end of the day, probably at 7 o'clock. The bell rings for him to get up about 11:30. He prays in his cell for half an hour. And then he goes to the church. This is the first time of the day that he goes to church. This is about midnight. He stays in the church for 2.5 to 3 hours, depending on the liturgy. For example, the Christmas office is very long, so he stays there longer. This is very difficult because if you've ever been in England during the winter, you know it's very damp. And this church has absolutely no central heating whatsoever. So as the hours wear on, the monks become colder and colder, and their feet become colder and colder. And if you were in the great cloister outside the church after the office ended, this is called the night office, you would hear what would be like a herd of buffalo, because all the monks in their cells are running in place trying to get some circulation back in their bodies. They go to bed then for another 4 hours. So usually they're getting up again about 6. They pray one of the little hours, and the title little hour means the hours that are said privately in cell. So they pray a little hour in cell. And then they go to church for Mass. and then they have a private Mass where they serve one of the solemnly professed monks who are always priests. After that, they go and study for a short while, pray another office at noontime. And after their noon, they have one meal a day, and that one meal a day is usually at about 11:30. After that, they have a required manual labor break. They're supposed to absolutely get out of their cells and do something useful. Most of them worked in their gardens. This 1,500 square foot apartment has a 1,200 square foot garden, and they can do whatever they want in the garden. They can plant flowers, they can plant vegetables, it's simply an exercise place for them. And they're required to do that if the weather is at all clement. Otherwise, they have a workshop at the bottom level of their cell, which is a carpenter's workshop. It has a lathe, a plane, and they do woodworking. If the weather is very bad, they could simply walk back and forth in the hallway, which they call the ambulacrum, which is the entrance to the cell. They leave the cell for the second time, actually for the third time in the day, to pray the office of Vespers, which is prayed in church, and that's very short. It takes about 25 minutes. And then they go back to then they go back to their cells, study, do manual labor again. In the summertime, they have a very small supper, probably a salad and some bread. And then at 7 o'clock, they go back to bed. Mm-hmm. And it's that way every day, every month, every year, from the time they enter the monastery until they die. So there's no variation.
Yeah, the changes are really tiny. Like, for instance, you might go from having tea to apple juice.
Exactly. That was a major change.
That's
in the fall.
That's a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
The cells are shaped like a U, and inside the U is a 5-acre garden where there are apples. And so the brothers in the fall take the apples and turn them into apple juice or hard cider. And so in the fall and early winter, they drink hard cider instead of tea.
Mm.
So the changes are so small that to us, we wouldn't even notice them. And yet within this culture, those are markers in the seasons of the year.
Mm-hmm. Silence pervades the charter house.
Yes.
So when may they speak, and what are they allowed to speak about?
Well, what surprised me is they're allowed to speak about anything when they can speak. I had thought that their speech would be limited to either holy topics or what was going on in the monastery. First of all, when could they talk? On Sunday, after the novices' chapter of Falls, which is a very, very ancient monastic custom where the monks confess their faults, they have an hour's recreation where all of them talk together. It's the only time when they can talk in a group. It's like a cocktail party. They mill around and they can talk about anything they want. They talk about their families. They talk about what they're reading. And they love to tell stories. It struck me over and over again that for people who were joining an order dedicated to silence, how much they like to talk. And mainly they tell stories. They love to tell stories about people who didn't make it.
Mm.
The ones who, when the cell door slammed, left. Or the ones who jumped over the wall in the middle of the night. And they talked about new monks coming, newcomers, and they would sort of speculate on who would come, who would be able to stick it out, and who would leave. So anyway, this was the hour on Sunday was when they all talked together. On Monday, each Monday, and this was looked forward to with great anticipation, they took a long walk, probably 3, maybe 4 hours, and they walked in pairs, 2 by 2, and the novice master would, every 20 minutes, change the rotation, and they would walk with somebody else. So in the course of, they probably talk to each one individually maybe twice a month, depending on the rotation. And that's when they would, it's the closest they got to establishing a personal relationship with another monk, because they would talk about their families or difficulties they might be having. Although typically they were not encouraged to talk about troubles they were having. The discussions were meant to be fairly, what we would call small talk. They talked about the food. They would talk about the weather. They would talk about the notices on the bulletin board. On the way into church, there's a bulletin board where the prior would post news that he thought was relevant to the monks, what they should know. And one of my favorite stories, if I may, is a young man from London entered just as everyone thought World War III was about to break out. And everything in the monastery is written and said in Latin. The monks speak Latin. Their classes are in Latin. The notice board has notices in Latin. And he didn't read Latin very well, so he thought World War III had broken out. And of course, he couldn't find out about it until another newcomer came. And on a walk, he found out that World War III hadn't broken out. But it's sort of like recess for them. After a very hard week, they get this long walk. They get to work up a sweat. And when they worked up a sweat, they didn't feel the hair shirt because the sweat sort of made it slippery. And that was what enabled many of them to persevere, was a chance to talk to the rest of them on this Monday walk.
Now, their quest is to find God, to get to God.
Yes.
To have God within themselves. So their lives are so internal. I'm wondering if, I've got a couple of callers here I want to get to pretty quickly, but do they speak about that inner, what they are about in cell, that search to connect to God?
That's an excellent question. Curiously, they're all in such different places. For example, St. Ignatius of Loyola has his rules to meditate on how to meditate, the spiritual exercises. The Carthusians simply put the novice in a cell, and their directions were to find God. So they have no common ground, and I have only one example of where the monks talked about their personal life, and for those who've read the book, it's the German novice, Dom Ignatius, and Dom Colombo, the doctor. Those are the only two who talked about their personal spiritual lives. They just were in different places at different times. I think it would have been helpful if they could have, but they didn't. I've asked them over and over again, and they simply did not talk about that. Which was their only reason for being there.
Let's talk with some listeners now. Our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine, Nancy Klein McGuire, her book, An Infinity of Little Hours. Our first caller this afternoon in Champaign on line one. Hi.
Hello.
Hello.
Yes. I was wondering if, maybe this is completely way off, if you've done any comparisons with other non-Western monastic traditions, or looked at Zen meditation, or that kind of thing. Or I know that there have been, like, I doubt that this has been done, obviously, because since it's outdated. I mean, it's no longer possible. But they've done studies of the brainwaves of Zen monks, for example. So I'm just wondering, also, you know, it's obviously a mystical quest, apparently.
Yes.
Of a union with God. And so they don't really say whether it's a positive or a negative, or via negative. There's like the expression via negativa of maybe a nothingness, or, you know, instead of trying to pray to God, just letting God enter, or I'm just wondering, I guess they don't talk about it, so you don't know what they're, I mean, how do they know when they, do they ever feel that they have reached God?
Yes.
They go up stages? Or stations, as they would say in the Sufi way?
Right. It is so similar to Eastern religion. It struck me as very much like Buddhists.
Uh-huh.
And this perhaps was 8 years ago.
Uh-huh.
One of the Carthusians, who had been in the order for perhaps 30 years, got permission to go and study with the Buddhists.
Uh-huh.
And when he got there, he was told that he wasn't even at the beginning of meditation. No,
uh-huh.
that he was so far behind.
Hmm. Maybe that's a part of the practice.
It's so similar.
Mm-hmm.
When I read Buddhist material, I think this is it. This is exactly what they're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
I could not find, in my experience of meeting these monks, in a couple cases, I would say, this monk has really made it. You know, he's been there.
Mm-hmm.
But the only documentation is from I'm reading this from my book. I'll just read a part of it. It's 15th century. A Carthusian monk in England says, on the feast of St. Peter in Chains, I was in the church at Mount Grace, and after celebrating Mass was engaged upon thanksgiving and prayer and meditation when God visited me in power. And I yearned with love so as almost to give up the ghost. How this can be, I will tell you, my brother, as best I can by the grace of God. Love and longing for the beloved raised me in spirit into heaven, so that, save for this mortal life, nothing would have been lacking to me of the glory of God who sitteth on the throne. Then did I forget all pain and fear and deliberate thought of anything, and even of the Creator. And as men who fear the peril of fire do not cry, fire has come upon my house, come and help me, since in their agony they can scarcely speak a word but cry, fire. Or if their fear be greater, they cry, ah, wishing to impart their peril. So I am my poor way. First I commended my soul to God, either in words or, as I rather think, in spirit. But as the pain of love grew more powerful, I could scarce have thought at all, forming within my spirit these words, love, love, love.
Mm-hmm.
And at last, ceasing from this, I deemed that I would wholly yield up my soul, singing rather than crying, in spirit through joy. Ah, ah, ah. And that's the only written document.
Mm-hmm.
But remember, these are extraordinarily private people,
mm-hmm,
who don't publish what they've written. They have the best libraries. They have the best theological libraries in the world, probably, except for the Vatican.
Mm-hmm.
But they don't publish.
Right.
They want to be anonymous. So I'm positive this is not a single experience. It's the only document I found.
Right. It does sound like one is almost saying a mantra.
Oh. Yes.
But to go in a very different direction, have you considered like kind of psychophysical things having to do with pain and pleasure and even possibly some kind of sadomasochistic approach? I mean, or maybe that in the 18th century some notions of sadomasochism came out of monasticism?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, I'm just curious.
These are very interesting questions. I think it depends so much on the individual monk.
Uh-huh.
Some of them certainly did not belong there.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them were there for very inappropriate reasons.
Right.
And some, the monks, the Carthusians called their houses charter houses rather than monasteries.
Mm-hmm.
Some charter houses were healthy, some charter houses weren't healthy.
Right.
And let's see, I'm trying to give a date. I think until about the 15th century, maybe 16th century, each charter house had a prison mm-hmm. where any monk who might be, who tried to leave or who was not behaving properly was put in this prison,
mm-hmm.
which kind of fits in with what you're saying.
Right, there's room for abuse.
Yes,
or
I am.
One might abuse oneself.
One can abuse oneself. I also, and this is, I'm not, obviously I'm not speaking for the order, I'm speaking for myself.
Mm-hmm.
I feel there certainly pre-Vatican II, there was abuse in the order of the superiors towards the young men.
Mm-hmm.
But what is so amazing to me, and I don't understand it,
mm-hmm.
is that the young men who, to me, were clearly abused are not bitter.
Mm-hmm.
They're not angry.
Mm-hmm.
They're not saying, this experience has ruined my entire life. They remain grateful for this experience. And
mm-hmm.
frankly, I don't understand it.
Right. I don't think it's something we can't understand, but there's something perhaps strange about pain and pleasure and denial and, yeah, I don't know what it means.
Does it mean something about the typical novice at this time, in 2006, they're older,
mm-hmm.
and the charter house that I'm talking about in the book had held 100 men in 1900, and in 1999 there were 12, and today there are 20, but there are only 5 of them who are solemnly professed. The
mm-hmm.
rest of them can leave anytime they want.
Mm-hmm.
Do
they still have a place if you want to leave and you solemnly confess that you can't leave?
If you're solemnly professed, you can get what's called, we would say leave, there's a Latin term for it, but we would say a leave of absence.
Mm-hmm.
They can be given for 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
They can live outside the monastery. It's the technical term is exclaustration.
Right.
And they're still solemnly professed, but they're living outside the monastery
mm-hmm.
for 3 years. But once they make solemn profession, only Rome, special congregation for religious rites can break their connection with the order.
Fascinating questions. I've got another listener waiting to talk with us who has been waiting patiently, and we only have about 10 minutes left in this portion of the program. So let's go and take this second call now. A listener in Rankin, line 4. Hi.
Hi, Celeste. Thanks for taking my call. Time is short, so I'll make just a quick question and a short story, and I'll hang up and listen off the line. I grew up on the south side of Chicago 50 years ago, and I remember I had old maid aunts that would make a donation to the Poor Clares, which was a cloistered group of nuns. And one of the most terrifying things I can remember as a small boy is going to this convent and having a wooden door slide open and a hand come out,
yes.
and a donation would be made, and then the door would close. Mm-hmm. And, of course, being a small boy, I was terrified. I didn't quite understand the concept. But as I understand it, these nuns never left the convent. They never saw anyone. It was quite terrifying. But then you kind of touched on it before. The flip side, the other question I had is, given their stark lifestyle, if they didn't go stark raving mad from loneliness, I was wondering if you had any information as to their lifespan. In other words, thinking that they have such a regimented lifestyle and then they did not abuse themselves with, you know, smoke or drink or what, overheating or anything. I was just curious as if they lived a normal life or if some of them lived quite a long time. And I'll go ahead and hang up and listen off there. Thanks.
Thank you for the question. They are various medical groups have asked to study them because they live such extraordinarily long lives. Living over 100 is not unusual for these men. And they seem to be mentally alert longer. Dom Columba in the book is 90 years old, and I got a lot of my detailed information from him. Maybe it's a regimented life. Maybe it's the fact they do exercise every day, and they take this long walk once a week. No one comes in from the outside. Is it possible that germs aren't coming in? I don't know. But they live very long lives, much longer than the norm would be.
What can you tell us about the call to this vocation?
There's a charter house in Vermont, which at the time of, not in 1960, it was just one monk who was there, and if someone wanted to be a Carthusian, they would go there to test their vocation. And so they would go there for a week and live the life, as I described it, getting up in the middle of the night to pray, etc. And when they, after the week, one of my five young men asked, do you think I should join the order? And he was told, he said, you can't stop yourself from joining it if it's there. It's a calling in a sense that I don't totally understand, but this young man went back to his life and he couldn't get this experience out of his mind until he left, and that seems to be it with all of them. And the other thing, and I'm not pretending to understand this, I'm merely reporting, none of them wanted to leave. They left either because they were asked to leave or because of severe psychological or physical health problems. But no one left voluntarily. And they all wanted to go back. I think it's a peculiar personality. Oh, that's not fair. Let me use an analogy. The bird called loons, like in Golden Pond. Okay, when you hear loons, you know that the wilderness is there.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't hear the loons, you know you've lost a piece of wilderness. And this particular species of men and women are like the loons. You know, as long as they're out there, you know that the spirituality that I think is inherent in everyone is there. I mean, everyone else is doing tons of other things, and their lives are immersed. I just got a letter from a very eminent professor in England whose wife is dying of cancer, and he is reading this book to her, and he wrote and said, thank you for showing us the emptiness of our plenty.
Mm.
So the monks, I think, are just a sign of the hardwired spirituality that seems to be in us. Now, why these particular men join, I don't know. Some of them was triggered by an incident. The young Irishman, who was very successful in business and in sports and with girls and with everything, was in the hospital for 6 months with a broken leg from playing rugby, and he saw all of the destitute people of Ireland, of Dublin, coming in and out of the emergency room. And his life, which had seemed to be very satisfying, seemed to be empty. For some reason, these men really want a personal relationship with God. And they think that an order which has lasted this long and has a reputation of getting people in contact with God is where they want to be. And it's when they get there, they feel at home. which is also an interesting concept of what home means.
Yeah. Well, it's an interesting way to go in search of God. I think that it's difficult for us to understand because I think when we think of people pursuing a quest to find God, we think of people who find it in service to others.
And that's not here at all.
Yeah.
It's a very radical, and which makes me wonder, with all the talk about the danger of radical religion, is religion dangerous? Here you have a very radical group of men who do not seem to be dangerous whatsoever to anyone, especially themselves. And not only do they live long, they are extremely well-balanced. That seems to be the criteria. To succeed in the life, you have to be very well-balanced.
I'm going to interrupt there, and I'm going to see if we can get another caller in.
Right.
Listener in Urbana on line one. Hi.
Hi. Did you say whether or not these charter houses are self-sustaining in a financial sense, or are they supported by the church or another community or whatever?
We haven't talked about that yet.
That's a very good question.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about this being merely unique. Very early, and I'm guessing maybe 1250, something like that, the order obtained permission to report directly to the Pope. It has nothing to do with any diocese. It is totally self-sustaining. The order, they're capitalists. In the beginning, they owned a lot of land, and in 1904, when French secularized and took over all the monasteries, they lost the land. But they still are totally self-supporting. They don't sell anything. They don't, you know, ask for contributions. If you've heard of the liqueur green chartreuse, the color chartreuse actually comes from the place where these monks originated, which is in the Chartreuse in the French Alps. The revenues from the green chartreuse built this monastery for 100 monks in England. But they're entirely self-supporting, but they don't sell jelly and that sort of thing. They're capitalists. They have land. They have stocks. They have bonds. They have people managing their money. And remember, the people who join are often extremely successful. I just stop me when I run out of time, but I have a list of the monks who were in the Charterhouse in 1960, an international lawyer who belonged to a prestigious London law firm, a Fordham professor, a medical doctor, the heir to a German dukedom, a member of the first Polish parliament, Oxford graduates, member of New Zealand's national rugby team. Going back farther, Petrarch's brother belonged to the Charterhouse. Richelieu's brother was the head of the Carthusians during the 17th century. So you're talking about a lot of inherited land and inherited wealth, which they did just a very good job of investing.
Yeah. And this surprised me. They have websites.
Yes. It amazed me. Totally amazed me.
One last question, and I'll give you a minute. Intellect and faith, are they parallel? Do they intersect for these men?
These men are highly intellectual. One of them at this time had two doctorates. You have the Fordham philosophy teacher. They spend their lives in cell when they're not out the three times a day in church, reading and meditating. They are extremely extremely intelligent, extremely versed in theology and philosophy. They're all priests, of course. I would say they use their minds they use their minds to a greater extent than most of us do. Because there's nothing on the outside. They have to turn inward.
Mm-hmm.
So that they, if you think of the astronauts who in 1960 were going into outer space, these men are going into inner space. And they're struggling with issues that we now struggle with on blogs and on the internet. Is the Da Vinci Code, you know, a legitimate movie or not? These issues are done by themselves in their interior. So they struggle. I mean, they have doubts. But they're done in inner space.
Yeah.
I can't think of another word. In the interior, in their interior life.
Yeah, we've got to leave it there. One of the things that kept me going through the book, it's a page turner. It's unexpected, but you know, when Patty O'Connell turns up at the gatehouse,
yes.
You know, he has this huge doubt. Mm-hmm. And
he still has it.
Yeah, that was really fascinating. There we have to leave it. We're out of time. We could talk much longer.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon. Been a pleasure. Nancy Klein McGuire has been our guest this afternoon in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. She is the author of An Infinity of Little Hours. The book is published by Public Affairs Books.